Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On the weather map, Hurricane Irma was wildly intimidating. In the Caribbean, the storm was devastating. The Keys hit hard. On the Florida Peninsula, Irma's path veered. Miami spared the worst, but plenty of impact as the U.S., for the first time ever, faced down its second Category 4 hurricane in a single year. This hour, On Point, what we've seen, what we've learned from Irma. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Did you survive Irma? Are you still in her path? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Over the weekend, you could not avoid it. Here's a montage by ABC News of the devastation as Hurricane Irma hits Florida.
Hurricane Irma shaking an entire state.
The powerful storm is making a slow march of Florida's spine.
We're feeling the brunt of Hurricane Irma right now.
The fierce winds clobbering both coasts.
Oh my God!
Construction cranes toppling over Miami's skyline, Naples underwater, and a test for Tampa not seeing a hurricane like this in nearly a century.
Joining us right now from Miami is Patricia Mazzei, reporter for the Miami Herald, who's been covering Irma. Patricia, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
You're safe and dry. You made it through the weekend. Miami feared the worst. You had a major evacuation there. In fact, what was the situation that Miami faced as the worst of Irma hit it?
At the peak yesterday, we had wind gusts at nearly 100 miles per hour recorded here at the airport. And what was really different about this storm is because it was so big, it was just so long. It was hours of rain and wind. And so even if it wasn't, thankfully for us, hurricane strength, you know, sustained winds, it was just so long that we had this pounding rain and winds. And that really, combined with the storm surge, led to this rising waters in coastal areas. Right now, we still have a lot of streets that are just impassable. The waters have receded some, but there is so much debris that there are curfews in place. And in the barrier islands, including Miami Beach, Key Biscayne, and, of course, the Florida Keys, they have said people just can't enter right now. So people have to stay away.
We know it's early to say, but we've all seen these images of the surge waters in the streets of Miami and Miami Beach. Do you begin, help us understand how widespread this was, how high those waters went, what the damage is likely to be? I know you don't have to have a dollar figure now, but is it bad damage from that, or did it just flow through the streets and the buildings are okay? Give us some sense.
I think it's actually the latter. From what we can tell, it was flowing on the streets. At some points, it was maybe waist high, but that was probably the highest that we saw. And like you said, we don't know what the damage is, but a lot of those waters have receded. Now, the situation might be a little different in Miami Beach. They have always had kind of bigger flooding issues. What was really surprising here was to see this on the streets of downtown Miami, these little rivers with cresting waves that just kept flowing past. And this is the area that they had evacuated in part for this reason, because they knew that even if it was just going to be, you know, 2 or 3 feet of storm surge, this was going to be a problem. The seawalls were going to be breached, and they were.
But at this point, do you have a sense of widespread circumstance where businesses and homes are taken out or not?
No, so far we do not have reports other than, you know, a roof that flew off here or there, trees falling on roofs. We have not seen widespread structural damage, luckily. The water was not Harvey water. You know, we're not talking about 6 foot high water that is going to stay in homes for days. Like I said, these roads Brickell Avenue, for example, if people are familiar with it, which is on the Miami Bay, the water there has receded. It had receded as of last night. So we're keeping our fingers crossed, but we have people right now checking out the damage, you know, all across the area.
Well, Patricia, you're in Miami as we speak, but cast your eye on across and up the state as far as you can. What about damage elsewhere? Marco Island, Naples, Tampa. Do you know what was hit hardest on the peninsula?
So after the storm hit the Keys, it made landfall in Marco Island and hit Naples as well. The dirty side of the storm, the eastern side, hit Naples. We understand that there is extensive damage. Still not as bad as people perhaps expected. The storm surge was not as high as the worst-case scenario, but we have seen video of flooded streets. We know that Everglades City, which is kind of south of Naples into the Everglades, is just incommunicated right now. It has flooded. No one has been able to reach it, not just reporters, but the firefighters have not been able to reach it, so we don't know what the situation is there. And because the storm made landfall at Marco Island further south from Tampa, Tampa was spared the worst-case scenario there as well. So I think they are heaving a sigh of relief and seeing some similar issues to Miami in terms of trees down and things like that. But so far, knock on wood, nothing that we have seen that has been to the level of what we imagined it could be.
Is it too much to say, given the... I mean, we all saw that huge, huge storm churning in the Atlantic with record wind speeds for a record amount of time. We saw the immense damage it did in the Caribbean. Is it too much to say that Miami, South Florida, even more broadly, is breathing some kind of relief at how it actually turned out?
Maybe. I would say it's early because we have not completed reports from the Florida Keys, and because they were the first ones to get hit, that is still a big question mark. The governor is flying down there to check out the damage. People there were not able to communicate yesterday, and some people had fled Key West thinking that's where the eye of the storm was going to hit, and the storm actually jogged east some 20 miles before it reached land, and it got people who had left Key West who were in the middle and upper Keys. The storm surge there was very bad. The Keys are very low lying. So I'd say we have to wait a little bit. And we are also seeing still rainfall in North Florida and in Jacksonville right now. There's a major flooding situation because of the combination of high tide, Irma storm surge, and the winds from Hurricane Jose out in the Atlantic. And they are sending search and rescue teams to help with the flooding in Jacksonville. So really no corner of this state has been spared the brunt of the storm.
And with the storm anticipated to just flow on up through the inland, through kind of the Mississippi Valley there or to the east of it. Let me ask you finally just another minute here, Patricia, about the evacuation. It's a very large evacuation, 6 million people in total on the move in advance of this storm. What's the chatter in Florida about that now? Are people happy that they got out? Because if the full hammer had come down, it could have been so devastating. Or are they saying, oh boy, wish I'd stayed home?
Well, the people who questioned whether coastal Miami-Dade was really at risk, I think saw that, in fact, it was right to say at least there's going to be storm surge here and to warn people in advance that there was going to be a water problem. Now, the storm chased some of the evacuees, people who had not gone to local shelters but actually left Miami to go to Naples or Tampa and then left to go to Jacksonville. And now they're finding that everywhere they go, they are
on their tail.
The effects of this. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Can't second guess it right now. The storm was so massive. And the potential for damage so great, grateful for whatever of that worst of it that Florida may have been spared here. But still, plenty of damage and the damage still being toted up. Patricia Mazzei is with the Miami Herald and joining us from Miami today. Patricia, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Here's a little sound of storm chaser Jeff Petrovsky going headfirst into 100-mile-an-hour wind and storm surges as Hurricane Irma touched down, as you heard Patricia say, there on Marco Island yesterday. Here he was documenting the storm's fury.
Everything's breaking apart. There's flying debris. The water look is coming up. Trees are flying, breaking off.
We've seen those images all weekend long. On Saturday, as the storm bore down, Florida Governor Rick Scott said, time to evacuate. If you've been ordered to evacuate, get out. Go now.
If you've been ordered to evacuate, you need to leave now. Do not wait. Evacuate. Not tonight, not in an hour. You need to go right now. If you're in evacuation zone, leave.
Among those who evacuated with his family, Benjamin Kurtman, professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Miami's Rosenstiel School of Marine and Atmospheric Science. He joins today from Atlanta, where he and his family took cover. Ben Kurtman, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me on the show, Tom.
So you've been watching all this. Is your home all right in Miami? Is everything okay back there? Do you know?
I really don't know just yet. Actually, I got a call from my neighbor, which I couldn't answer because I'm talking to you today, so I'll call him back as soon as I get off the phone.
You must be itching to do that. Everybody must be very curious about what the scene is back home. How and when, I mean, you're a professional. You were watching this, professor of atmospheric sciences. How and when did you decide, Ben, to go?
Well, we left first thing Wednesday morning. It looked to me like a pretty serious storm, my home is in evacuation area A, which is the lowest lying areas, and even though I'm actually at 15 feet, and so we heeded the order and we left as soon as it was announced that they were evacuating zone A.
What did you fear, and what have we seen?
Well, my biggest fear, of course, with this storm was the storm surge. There was a period of time when we left town that the worst case scenario was in fact Miami-Dade, and they were thinking, maybe up to 12 feet of storm surge. And when you add on wave action on top of that, that could do some real serious damage in Miami-Dade coastal zone. So we were very concerned about that. And then, of course, Category 4 or 5 wind damage could also be quite severe. So in some sense, we got lucky. The storm went across Cuba a little bit more than we had the forecast had anticipated. So that knocked down the storm a little bit. And then, of course, most recently, it stayed more inland than anticipated, and that's also had knocked down the storm some. So for much of, for good parts of Florida, maybe it perhaps wasn't as bad as anticipated. But like Patricia said, we're still worried about the Keys and to hear about things in Naples and Fort Myers.
An element of luck, perhaps, there. You must have been very sobered when you looked out at the images of this storm gathering in the Atlantic.
Oh, absolutely. When we were watching this storm develop watching the forecast models project its path and develop the storm, I was very concerned. Not only for my person, but and my family and home, but also for all of Florida. This storm was a monster in its size, so even though it did get knocked down a little bit, just the breadth of the storm, the radius of hurricane-force winds and tropical storm-force winds is just phenomenal. There was a period of time when the entire state of Florida was feeling the rainfall from Irma.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from ZipRecruiter, who understands when you run a business, you've got important decisions to make every day, like hiring. ZipRecruiter makes finding quality candidates simple. With one click at ZipRecruiter.com/OP, you can post your job to 100 leading job sites across the web and manage your candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to hire. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Irma, what we saw, what we feared, what we got, and what we have learned from this massive hurricane as it came across the Caribbean and then ashore in the continental United States. Sound of heavy rain and wind there of Irma hitting Merritt Island, Florida yesterday. Now downgraded to a tropical storm and headed north, still with packing a lot of water along with it. You can join us this hour. Were you ordered to evacuate? Did you? What do you see in the images out of the Caribbean, out of Florida, out your window? Did the preparation feel orderly or not? And how often can we take a 6 million person evacuation? Florida's Governor Rick Scott talking evacuation on Saturday by Sunday. He was urging those who had not left, who were still there, to hunker down until the winds and water died down. Audio is a little rough, but here was the Florida governor.
The storm surge will rush in and could kill you. We have thousands of National Guard members and Fish and Wildlife officers on standby to help with search and rescue as soon as it is safe. But they cannot help you until the storm has passed. You need to stay in a safe place.
If you were still there, stay in a safe place. And the path of the storm, well, it changed as it went. This happens. Here was CNN correspondent Sarah Seidner in Daytona Beach. This was about 6:30 a.m. this morning, talking about the unpredictable nature of then Hurricane Irma.
Irma has been one tricky storm for a lot of folks because even the emergency responders here, they're watching it as we are, and all the meteorologists were watching it too, thinking that it was going to go up sort of the west coast, and yes, we would get some of the bands, and we were getting some of the bands, but it was very, very light, not worth really mentioning it was that light, and then suddenly everything changed, and as we got later later and later into the night, and then into the morning hours, things got outrageous, where these winds were whipping up, and as it turned out, the eye was starting to come right across Daytona Beach.
We've got Benjamin Kurtman with us from the University of Miami's Rosenstiel School of Marine and Atmospheric Science, professor of atmospheric science there. He and his family, their home in evacuation area A in Miami, they got out. He joins us today from Atlanta. And Ben, we've got callers coming in right now. I want to grab a couple here, if I may. Oldsmar, Florida, Jillian's calling. Hi, Jillian, you're on the air. Where are you? What have you seen?
Oldsmar is just northwest of Tampa, and we were spared the worst. I mean, me and my family spent the past 3 days preparing, getting supplies, making a safe room, and I'm really glad we did, but we really didn't see the raft that we expected. I feel really bad for my neighbors and friends down south. It seems like they've kind of had a worse situation. But up here, I mean, it's largely okay. There's a few trees down in our neighborhood. You know, a few roads are closed. There's a few traffic stops that are out.
Were you prepared for worse, Jillian? Did you bring in supplies and all the rest? Did you think about even leaving?
Oh, yeah. We had a ton of water, canned food, gas. We really stocked up because, you know, as of Thursday, Friday, we thought we were going to hit, you know, get a direct hit. It would have been terrible.
Are you glad for all the bracing and preparation that Floridians did, including the evacuation, even though some may have been spared the worst?
Absolutely. I think Governor Scott and the rest of our, you know, elected officials who made these decisions did so with the best interest of everyone in mind. I mean, evacuation zones A and B, which are near the coastal areas, they were all evacuated as of Friday. And I think that was prudent. I mean, at the very last minute, this thing turned and went kind of east. But it had it gone west, it would have been just as bad as we expected.
Lucky in a way, though. Plenty of damage here, terrible damage in the Caribbean. And we're still toting up in the Florida Keys themselves. Jillian, I'm glad you're safe there, northwest of Tampa. Nicole's calling from Sarasota, Florida. Nicole, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling from Sarasota, but I live on Cudjoe Key.
Just north of Key West.
Exactly where the storm hit.
What have you heard from home? Do you know anything about what happened there?
I've only seen pictures, a few pictures here and there. It looks absolutely devastating for my friends, my neighbors, and I don't know what my house looks like, but I'm pretty sure that it's not going to be good. It's absolutely terrifying to not know, but the devastation is horrendous, and it's terrible to think that to what we see on the news that people think we dodged a bullet, and we didn't.
Yeah,
there's thousands of people down there who lost all their homes, their livelihoods, and I don't want people to forget that.
We absolutely do not forget it, and we cross our fingers for the best outcome there. But of course, as we speak, that is not fully revealed. Are you glad you got out? Did you ever consider hunkering down there, Nicole, just north of Key West, Cudjoe Key?
Oh, I absolutely never considered hunkering down. That storm track was shifting a little bit, but never shifted enough to make me think I should stay. We went to Sarasota when the storm track looked like it was going to go up the east coast of Florida. But when it went west, the house that we evacuated to in Sarasota was still relatively safe nonetheless, so we stayed.
Are you going to go back? Let's say there is devastation. Will you go back and rebuild? How do you feel about living in the Florida Keys in a century of climate change?
Yes, we are going back. My husband's work is there. We're going back. When we rebuild, we will. Our house is 15 feet high. We have insurance, but we will evaluate how we rebuild and take a look at what we can do to fortify. But we're there because of work. So. Otherwise, we wouldn't be there. And I want to also say that there's a lot of people down there who are working class. When you think of the Keys, you think of wealth. There's a lot of working class, middle class people like us down there.
Of course.
And it's not just second homes down there. I'm very wealthy. So keep that in mind as well. A lot of just normal, average people live down there and scraping out a living.
Who may be up against enormous challenges when it comes to rebuilding and all the rest. Nicole, stay safe, and we wish the best for you and all of your neighbors there in the Florida Keys, and I appreciate your call. Ben Kurtman in Atlanta, Georgia, I mean, you must be thinking about what we will ultimately see out of the Keys. We've seen terrible images out of the Caribbean itself in St. Martin, Virgin Islands, some very difficult damage there, and beyond. I mean, even though some may not have been hit as hard as feared, there's no ignoring the damage that this storm's already done, Ben.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, my heart and thoughts really go out to Nicole and her friends and family and all those in the Keys that may have suffered tremendous loss. And we really do need that damage assessment. And I'm really hoping that there is no loss of life. And it's really quite frightening how bad it could be. And she's right. We do need to remember that, you know, while maybe big parts of Florida were spared some of the worst, there are parts of Florida, in the Keys in particular, and Naples, that really has suffered a lot of damage, and we're not going to know for some time just how bad it really was.
It's kind of terrifying that you can have a storm of this power, and to a layperson, it seems like kind of a roll of the dice where it comes on shore. I mean, just change this just a couple of degrees, and you could have tremendous devastation. These do not come often. Put this in historical context for us, Ben. Just how big, how bad was this? If it had hit wrong, what might that have meant?
Well, yeah, it was certainly one of the most powerful hurricanes in the modern instrument record, when we measure hurricanes, in the modern instrument record that we've had in the Atlantic ever. Its scale, you know, when you compare it to the damage that was done with Andrew, this storm was huge compared to Andrew. It had nearly 100-mile swath of hurricane force winds, and much greater than that tropical storm force wind. So this storm could have wiped out a huge portion of the state of Florida and more. We got lucky in some sense, given Nicole's concerns about the Keys and elsewhere, but we did get a little bit lucky in that the storm hugged Cuba a little bit longer than anticipated, so it interacted with the land there, so it got knocked down in terms of its strength a little bit because of that. And also that jog to the east towards the end there brought it more inland, which also tended to have interaction with land over Florida, which that tended to weaken the storm. But this storm, in terms of as a scientist, just looking at this storm, this is one of the most spectacular storms we've ever seen in terms of its strength, its power, its size. So it's really quite remarkable historically.
I've heard for years about this is a once-in-100-year storm or a once-in-a-500-year storm. Can you rank Irma in those terms for us, Ben?
I can't do that at the moment, but I'm sure we will. It's certainly one in 50-year type of storm. It might even be more historical than that. Like I said, it's probably the strongest storm we've seen in the Atlantic in the modern instrument record. But the question that people are going to be raising now, and it's something that we need to really talk about, is: are we going to see more of these kinds of historical storms? Is the 1-in-100-year storm now becoming a 1-in-20-year storm or a 1-in-10-year storm? Things are warming up in the Caribbean and in the Atlantic. We're getting warmer sea surface temperatures. That's the fuel that drives these storms and allows them to get so strong. So are we starting to see an era where we're going to see more and more very, very powerful storms?
I want to look at exactly that issue. Stephen Flynn joins us just a moment from the Global Resilience Institute. Michelle in Nashville, Tennessee. Michelle, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thank you, Tom. I live in Nashville, but my daughter, my son-in-law, and my grandbaby are from St. Thomas. Luckily, they were visiting me, and he went back early. They stayed with me, my daughter and grandbaby. The eye of the hurricane actually hit St. Thomas North Shore twice.
You're talking the Virgin Islands here, Michelle, yes.
Yes, I am talking the Virgin Islands, St. Thomas, and St. John.
And what are you hearing? What's the damage?
I've started to see pictures. My house, I have roof on part of it. Part of it, the windows, doors are all blown out. I've got neighbors that do not have houses at all, so they're staying because there is a generator at my house. They're coming to my house to stay.
Yep.
There's looting. There's people are trying to get folks off the island. My daughter has been working on an evacuation schedule out of Crown Bay, where owners of boats that were not hurt in, say, Puerto Rico, are bringing their boats and taking women and children to Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
It is devastating. You talk about it was hit twice.
Yes.
And I don't think there's any national media on St. John or St. Thomas yet. But they are the U.S. Virgin Islands. These are United States citizens.
Absolutely. And to be hit twice by Irma, that's a couple of big hits. And we have seen images that really just look horrendous out of there. I'm glad you've got part of your roof. I don't know what that's going to mean, but we wish the best of luck to you and your family there, Michelle. Benjamin Kurtman, please stand by there in Atlanta, Georgia. Stephen Flynn joins me now, founding director of the Global Resilience Institute, professor of political science at Northeastern University. Stephen Flynn, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Is it time to imagine once in 100 or once in a 50-year storms coming more regularly? And if it is, what does that mean in terms of resilience? What does that now require?
It is time, probably past time, that we consider this. What we don't know is necessarily the frequency at which these events will happen, but we almost are certain that they'll become more intense. So they'll be a bit like the Irma story and the Harvey story. The other reality, though, is that we're essentially increasingly have moved ourselves into harm's way. We've increasingly concentrated where we live and how we live in areas that are highly exposed, especially coastal cities. Mm-hmm. And the challenge for us really is to think about what can we do in advance to bake in essentially our resilience to better withstand these events, but very importantly as well to think through the recovery afterwards. And can we build back better and smarter? What's a bit insane is that we often treat these events as if they're rare and unknowable. They're actually less rare, and there's a lot that we know about them and know not just when they're going to happen. That's a bit of a crapshoot. But what we do know likely is if they play out, how they impact on the things we value, the things that we need, and begin to plan how to mitigate those risks so that these damages are not so huge.
When you note that we have built up in these coastal areas which are vulnerable, are you suggesting that recovery should mean removal? Can we afford to build back in a way that, I mean, can anything really withstand the impact of a storm like Irma if it hit straight on?
Well, the answer probably to the last question is no. I mean, if it's a Cat 4, Cat 5 direct on, you're in the crosshairs, you're probably going to lose. But we know, is of course, these are big storms and that it's the surrounding areas that may be impacted. And there's also this sort of cascading failures that can happen when you lose essentially when you have flooding that takes out wastewater treatment facilities and disrupts pipelines and refineries and so forth. These are key assets that we know we can do a better job of safeguarding. And that work is about mapping up front what is likely to be in harm's way and how is it connected or interconnected to each other? And what can we do to better make sure that we mitigate those cascading effects so that when they happen, it's a more localized event. You know, the greatest storm in terms of casualties in U.S. history is the great hurricane of 1900 that hit Galveston, and there were tragically 6,000 lives lost at that storm. But it was a local disaster. It was horrific, and it impacted locally. What we see about these events, like in Florida, the entire 6 million-plus people have to be evacuated, or what we're seeing around Houston in terms of that impact, is that – and that's not just local – the refineries for our nation are largely concentrated in the Gulf Coast. So when we have a hit there, it ends up disrupting supply for fuel for the whole rest of the country, as people are seeing as they go to the fuel pump. So these connections can be understood and much better managed. The bottom line here, we got to stop treating these as rare natural events and really start focusing on building into our infrastructure the understanding that these events will happen from time to time, and we have to be much better able to withstand them and much better able to recover from them if they're not going to be catastrophic for us.
Ben Kurtman there in Atlanta, are you prepared as an atmospheric scientist to say, these are going to come around more often, or is even that an unknown at this point?
Well, there is compelling scientific evidence that the strongest storms are going to be stronger, and there's a good scientific basis for that. And that as the oceans warm, that's really the fuel for these storms. And so, the possibility of an Irma like again in the future, the chances increase. So, if Irma was 1 in 100 year storm, in the next 10 years, maybe Irma will be a 1 in 10 year storm or a 1 in 20 year storm. So, we are really at that point where we can say we're going to see on the higher end more powerful storms. You know, whether they're going to make landfall and where they're going to make landfall, that we can't do. You know, the Harvey, for example, we could have said, you know, it's going to have more moisture and it's going to rain out a lot more, but that it was going to sit there for so long over Houston, perhaps we couldn't have done that. And we can't necessarily connect that with climate change. But as the climate's changing and the climate system is warming, we do expect more powerful Category 3, 4, and 5 storms.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking about Irma, Hurricane Irma, now Tropical Storm Irma, what we saw, what we feared, what we got, and what we have learned from this immense storm. Huge damage in the Caribbean. Florida, plenty of damage there as well. It's still being toted up, and now it's headed on up through the panhandle and deeper into the inland continent. Do we just dry out, rebuild, and wait for the next one? Will climate change eventually force us to retreat? Is it pushing us right now? What does resilience mean in the face of a storm like Irma? Widespread damage in the Caribbean. Here was a reporter describing the wreckage in Barbuda, a small island in the eastern Caribbean. Barbuda was devastated by the storm.
What we experienced is like something you see in a horror movie. Persons were literally running from house to house, and we had cars flying over our heads. We had containers, 40-foot containers, flying left and right.
Construction cranes coming down in the U.S. Here was Fox News on one of those coming down in Florida.
We've just received word that another construction crane has collapsed in Florida. This time it's in Fort Lauderdale. This is thanks, of course, to Irma's bruising hurricane force winds.
Okay, think about that. Irma taking the construction cranes down as the people trying to put the buildings up. And when the scramble to evacuate came on, people headed all over the place. Here's one, a Floridian. Think about how far they felt they had to go to get out of harm's way.
We couldn't get a flight anywhere. We tried New Jersey, where we're originally from. We tried Chicago. We tried every place. The only two seats they had was to L.A. So here we are.
Evacuated from Florida to L.A. I mean, it's just a sign, Ben Kirtman, of how this can throw people's lives into such a tizzy. Ben is a professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Miami. Stephen Flynn is with us as well from the Global Resilience Institute at Northeastern University. I mean, Ben, evacuation is no small thing. 6 million people. This is a major movement of humans and the kit that goes with them.
It sure was. And relatively speaking, it went fairly smoothly. There's a lot of concern when you have major evacuations that when you call for them that there's a risk of loss of life associated with the evacuation, accidents and things like that, that you end up losing more people than if you hadn't evacuated in the first place. So the fact that it went as smoothly as it was is quite remarkable. I know people were frustrated in traffic. I know I struggled with a lot of traffic,
mm-hmm.
but on balance, it seemed to have worked fairly well.
Tyler in St. Petersburg, Florida, right down where people, as this thing developed, were very afraid of significant damage. Tyler, thank you for calling. You're on the air. What have you seen?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. The damage down here has been substantial in kind of the residential areas. We've been seeing transformers popping all night last night, and we're about 50% without power. Thankfully, we have it. But downtown's been coming together pretty quick. There's stations up for coffee and food. Local officials are out making sure everyone gets to where they need to go. Local food owners and restaurant owners are all out making sure everyone's got food and coffee to kind of get through the day to start the cleanup.
But you don't see a flattened St. Petersburg. I mean, you still got coffee shops giving out coffee.
Yes, thankfully. The wind damage wasn't as severe as we would have thought. There's an occasional roof down throughout some of the neighborhoods. But all in all, we've held together pretty well.
I appreciate your call, Tyler. Good luck to you there. Lakeland, Florida. Jeff is calling. Hi, Jeff. You're on.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call. Lakeland and Polk County in general, it was kind of at the last minute that they realized that it had kind of taken a turn to come towards us more inland. But it just goes to show you that no matter where you are, you can be hit by these hurricanes. There's pretty substantial damage here in terms of trees down, power lines. My parents' house has no power. My grandma's house has no power. But it could have been a lot worse as well. Like, if this was a Category 2, I shudder to think what it would have been if it had been a 5 when it did.
Yeah, we all shudder to think of that, Jeff, and I appreciate your call. One more from Florida. Thank you, Jeff. Kira in Newport Richey, Florida. Kira, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm in Pasco County, Florida, which is just about 40 minutes north of Tampa Bay. And we're just headed back to our houses right now just to assess the damage. But we made a very last-minute decision to leave about 4 miles in yesterday morning before the storm came through. So we just packed everything up and left. But I guess the one major thing to learn from this whole thing is, like, my twin sister and I were almost 33 years old, and we've lived in Florida our whole lives, and we've never seen anything like this. And it's just crazy that we never are prepared enough. So the psychological stress this whole week has just been insane. So, but we were lucky enough. We were able to keep power where we were. But it's just been crazy.
Kira, let me ask you, if you live in Florida, hurricane potential is part of the deal, and people have known that for a long time. But not storms of this size before, and not with the frequency that we're now being told they may be faced. Does it change the way you think about living in Florida?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't have any intentions to move or anything, but I think our family, we're definitely going to be prepared from now on. It's just we've been so lucky in our area to never take a direct hit like this, and we, you know, you just kind of grow used to that idea. But this, we were thinking yesterday it was just going to hit at a 4. And like you guys were saying earlier, there's really nothing you can do when it hits at that strength. So we're just really lucky. And the houses in our area are older. They're like 30, 40, 50 houses.
Yeah.
So we just felt it was necessary to go about 4 miles in with a two-story house at a friend's house just in case of the storm surge. So
sounds like a wise precaution. Physical damage, of course, can come with this, and psychological stress as well. And I'm sure many people have felt that. Ben Kirkman, can you describe for us how this storm formed? What came together to create that enormous swirling mass in the Atlantic?
Good question. So what we have are these disturbances that come off the coast of Africa. They're called easterly waves. These disturbances come off Africa. They start to develop a sort of a circulation. Thunderstorms start to embed. They get over warm water. And it's, you know, moving slowly across this warm water, and there's more and more thunderstorms, and they just sort of, you know, have this positive feedback. Whereas this, as the thunderstorms become more intense, that forces more evaporation from the ocean to fuel the thunderstorms, and they just keep spinning up and spinning up. And this one, because it had a long time to cross the Atlantic, and it was over very, very warm water, and there was very little wind shear to shear the storm off, and the atmosphere was very moist. There wasn't any dry air, so this storm really took off.
You now got the mayor of Tampa saying they've dodged a bullet, but plenty of concerns. Their power restoration, we're told, could take weeks after Hurricane Irma, weeks, and we've seen millions without power. Florida Department of Health warning that wildlife, snakes, alligators have been, quote-unquote, displaced by Irma. Watch out for that. You've got traveling north, of course, 800 flights canceled out of Atlanta today. Stephen Flynn, you look at resilience. Can Florida be resilient for the long term, the whole thing?
Well, it certainly has some challenges, right? We've been racing to develop an area that is prone for these kinds of disasters. I mean, the basic challenge is geography. It's very low-lying. And so one of the real concerns is rising sea level combined with storm surge. So 20, 30 years from now, we may just have nuisance tides that are causing the kind of flooding we've seen in some places.
Already Miami faces that with some regularity. The streets flooded just kind of out of the blue.
Yeah, absolutely. Miami Beach particularly is very, very vulnerable. So some thinking has to go into that. But more broadly, it turns out like 9 out of 10 Americans, if they stay put for 30 years, a life of a mortgage, are probably going to be directly impacted by some disaster. We have a lot of mayhem in the North American continent. If wildfires, nor'easters
right
here
now
up in the Northeast, earthquake damage, the mega quake risks out in Cascadia. So all of us need to be thinking about what is it that we can be doing as a society to be better prepared for these events. We shouldn't just learn that we should do something after it happens. And we shouldn't just be focusing on this conversation only when the trauma is in our face. And that's something that really is going to take a sustained effort.
I mean, some of these are perpetual threats that have always been and will always be. Others may be enhanced by climate change. What about the economics of this? Can we afford the posture of greater readiness, the construction costs of more resilient infrastructure, businesses, homes?
It's just the opposite. We cannot afford to. We can't afford not to make these investments, particularly over time. What we're really seeing is that things we're hoping to be around for 60, 80 years may not be around if they're not constructed properly. So that if we're going to have particularly the things that we rely on, from bridges and roads to water treatment and refineries and so forth, we have to essentially design those things right. But it's not all about cost. It's a lot about being prepared and understanding where water may come in a community. You know, we could be thinking more about surgical evacuations instead of massive ones. So what do I mean by that? We basically can map out where water can go in any given neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And some of those, chances are, some of those homes are going to be in higher ground than others. And you could have localized evacuations, but that requires us really to understanding risk with and how it will play out.
And communicating that with the public so they know what to anticipate.
Exactly. And there's some pushback. Developers don't necessarily want that information to be out there, and even homeowners don't want to know that with too much precision if it leads to higher insurance rates. This is one of the challenges we're going to see, of course, is that many of the people did not have insurance, and so they will not be able to recover, obviously, as capable as we like them, because they simply didn't carry the insurance.
Mm. Ben Kirtman, there you are in evacuation area A, and you're a climate scientist. I mean, your atmospheric sciences is your thing. You're looking at this century. You're looking at warmer seas, which means, as you say, stronger storms. What's in the back of your mind about whether you'll spend the rest of your days in that home, whether your children will inherit and live there, or that won't be possible?
Well, I think, you know, South Florida, myself included, I think we need to start really thinking about exactly what the other caller was talking about, a resilient Miami. So how do you design your infrastructure? How do you design where you're going to build homes and where people are going to live, so that when a big storm comes through, compounded by sea level rise, how you recover rapidly? So, for example, you know, do we really want to build homes all along the coastal zone, or do we want to build along the coral ridge where I am at around 15 and a half feet? So do you want to build homes more clustered around transportation and get, you know, have people less on the roads? Do we need to return some of parts of Florida back to its natural environment to help us with the storm surge, but also the sea level rise problem and periodic flooding?
Like what kind of parts? How big an area if you went down that road?
Well, I mean, there might be parks and things and golf courses that we're just going to have to say, you know, in the face of sea level rise, that we're going to allow those, we're going to build those areas so that they, during the high tide season, they're going to flood. And we're going to be okay with that, and that when the water dissipates, it can return to a park. But there are going to be periods of time when we're not going to be able to use that, because that's going to be part of our stormwater management system and our flood control system in the face of sea level rise and even storm surge. So those are tough mm-hmm. decisions. Those are generational decisions. You know, where, you know, there are going to be people that are going to have to be relocated. But I also believe that if we start having that conversation, we start really thinking about it using the best available science, we can design a Miami and a Miami Beach that'll be here for 50 years and that we will want to stay.
Steve Flynn, how do you steer an area, an economy, toward resilience? I mean, contractors come in, or developers, and, you know, their economics are pretty simple in a way. Put it up, sell it, and move on to the next project. So they're not necessarily invested in resilience. They may resist exactly this kind of talk. It's going to make those developments more expensive or smaller units. I don't know what it would be.
Yeah, at its heart, it's about urban planning or any town planning, zoning. These are the nuts and bolts issues. And it's truly local that these decisions are often made.
But are the powers there now to require that it be done right or not?
They're not. And in most cases, we're not using the incentives we have. And one big one is the carrots that the federal government can provide, as it provides assistance for building roads, for building mass transit systems, for providing assistance post the disaster. You know, billions of dollars will be spent in Houston and in Florida, and we want to be generous. But we could leverage that to essentially drive the kinds of assessment and change behaviors and make things conditional. If a location wants to have essentially wide open development, yep. we're going to be less generous. We're not going to give as much and make that commitment up front.
Okay.
And then say, but if you take measures, you take you investigate the risk, you and buy insurance, you're prepared and you exercise your plans, then we're going to be more generous. We're going to provide you a calibrated level of restoration funding, because we want to reward good behavior.
Does that require the federal government to take on board the message we're hearing that climate change is going to make these things more frequent. I mean, if it's still a 1 in 100 year storm, maybe you don't have to require that. But if you have to wake up and say, my gosh, it might be 1 in 10 years.
It should take that on, but it doesn't even need to, because what we know is that these events are happening and they're far more costly because we're more interconnected and connected in the urban way that we live. And so that when damages happen, and the infrastructure we have is old and not that well cared for, so we need to get out in front of this problem. And again, we're going to have events like earthquakes as well that are not so much climate driven, but still will have massive – they won't be local impacts. They'll be regional and hugely costly
for
our nation.
Who's going to pay for all this? You say it's expensive. Expensive not to do it, but we know it's easier to kick the can down the road and think about paying for it afterward. We're talking about cutting taxes in this country right now. Can we do that and build a resilient nation?
There's a lot that actually, when we bring the kind of creativity together, when we are actually upgrading infrastructure, we're designing things for the first time, where there's real opportunities to make this affordable. At the same time,
that sounds like happy talk. Forgive me.
Yeah,
but
no,
it sounds expensive to put
yeah.
in this.
Well,
resilient
it is. I mean, it's not. It's pay me now or pay me later is the basic issue.
That,
and the real issue is like, do you tune your car up or not? I mean, mm-hmm. these are the kinds of investments that often need to be made. I think what people need to understand is not about just massive walls or construction. It's thinking where we live and how we live a little bit differently. And a little decisions left to the right can make a big, big difference about a local disaster being bad versus catastrophic for a much broader region.
Who's going to steer that kind of woke attitude toward risk here? Federal government?
Well,
local government?
It's going to take all of us, and that's our commitment at the Global Resilience Institute and in the university world, is to help educate our students, but also do the research to help us do this better and smarter.
Well, we are listening very closely today as Irma has left that path of destruction across the Caribbean. We'll see what comes out of the Keys, now churning up inland in the continental United States. Stephen Flynn, Director at the Global Resilience Institute at Northeastern University. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Benjamin Kurtman, Professor of Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Miami's Rosenstiel School of Marine and Atmospheric Science. Ben, good luck to your family. They're evacuated in Atlanta. Hope you're home safe and sound in Miami soon.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, everybody, for joining us today. Good luck to all. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.